This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening and welcome to the Birch Aquarium. My name is Nigella Hillgarth and I'm the Executive Director of the Birch Aquarium at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. And tonight it is the Jeffrey B. Graham Perspectives on Ocean Science Lecture Series, and I am delighted to welcome tonight's speaker and a little short introduction to him tonight. His name is Dr. Bryce Semmons, and he is an assistant professor here at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. And much of his current research focuses on quantitative ecology, specifically Bayesian statistics, time-space series analysis, state-space model formulations, and information-theoretic approaches to model selection. So that really means that he's very interested in lots of aspects of marine ecology, conservation biology, coral reef ecology, and fisheries management. And he's worked on a variety of different species, including coral reef fish, salmonids, southern resident killer whales, and coastal groundfish. And it also says here that he's worked on coastal gray wolves. And I'm assuming that those are not underwater wolves. So please join me in a big welcome for Bryce for his presentation, which is entitled Grouper Moon, Saving One of the Last Great Populations of an Endangered Caribbean Reef Fish.
All right, thank you all for having me. I'm going to try not to yell into this microphone. You are the brave souls that made it out in this northern push of weather that's come our way. So thank you for braving the freezing temperatures, at least for Southern California. I'm going to try and take you to a tropical place and relieve your mind of the burdens of this cold weather. I'm going to talk to you today not about Bayesian statistics or any of the math, but really about a conservation project. So there's two parts of what I do here at Scripps. One is more of the quantitative tools and techniques development. The other part is really investigating spatial ecology and marine conservation biology of species that we care a lot about. This is one such project. This is called the Grouper Moon Program, and it's a joint or collaborative research project between the Cayman Islands Department of the Environment, the Reef Environmental Education Foundation, and my lab here at SIO. So, how many of you are divers here? Okay, about half, more or less. How many of you dove in the Caribbean? Okay, and of those, how many of you seen a Nassau grouper? Just a few, two or three. Okay, you are some of the lucky few who have seen a Nassau grouper on its native home reefs in the Caribbean. They are only found in the Caribbean. And what I'm going to do is tell you a story about the problems, the slings and arrows that Nassau grouper have been facing over the last few decades. And then hopefully at the end of this story, I'll turn it around into a ray of hope based on the research that we've been doing down in the Cayman Islands. Nassau grouper really are a Caribbean icon. When you go diving on a reef, if you see a Nassau grouper, it really is an amazing experience. People care a lot about that experience, and so on dive magazines, on Wish You Were Here postcards from the Caribbean, on stamps, on jewelry, Nassau grouper are prominently featured. And in large part, they're prominently featured because they represent to a lot of people what a wild and healthy reef should look like, in large part because they are they're a large predator, right? They're like a lion or a tiger on an African savanna, only, of course, on a Caribbean coral reef. So people care a lot about them. They're an important species, not just because we care about them, although that's definitely true. They're also an important species because they are a top predator on Caribbean coral reefs, and because of that, they have a very structuring role on how Caribbean coral reef ecosystems work. They're also, at least at the turn of the last century, they're a very highly valuable fishery. That's not so much the case anymore, but 100 years ago, they were arguably the single most important finfish fishery in the entire Caribbean basin. And then finally, they are photogenic and charismatic, and honestly, you can snuggle with them. So this is video I shot of a fish by the name of Gentle Ben on Little Cayman, on a dive site called Bloody Bay Wall. Ben was a resident on Bloody Bay, and when he saw you, he would swim into you. So this is Ben seeing me come up to him, and he turns around and basically rams me in the chest. And I get to have a nice pet session with him. And you could actually pick this fish up and stick him in your BC pocket and swim around the dive reef with him. Very, very, very friendly. And that's an amazing experience to have as a diver. People seek out that experience. It's one of the when you talk to divers that go dive on Bloody Bay Wall, one of the most famous dive sites of anywhere in the world, what they talk about as an experience, oftentimes on the boat ride back home, is not necessarily the amazing scenery and the great wall. They talk about the fact that they had this amazing interaction with the wild creature. And so people care a lot about it. Because of that, Nassau Grouper represent a great conservation target. They're an important large predator on Caribbean coral reefs, but they're also something that people can get behind in terms of a conservation target. And so when we affect conservation action on the species, most likely we're going to do a good job of making it happen, and we're going to bring a whole suite of species with it in terms of the reef ecosystem and communities. But they're not doing well. So throughout the entire range, over the past 30 to 40 years, there's been a dramatic decline in the species, almost everywhere. There's a few rare exceptions, but almost everywhere, they've been virtually removed from the system. In places that have been particularly hard hit, like Florida and Bermuda, where the fishery has completely collapsed, despite decades of complete no-take protection for the species, it's failed to recover completely. There's been no appreciable recovery in the species. And so when you get an animal whose population has declined very, very rapidly and who is failing to respond to concerted management action, that's a slam dunk for listing under the IUCN Red List criteria, and so Nassau Grouper have been listed as endangered. That puts them on the same footing as the giant panda or the blue whale. If you read the IUCN listing document, you would see that the main reason given for why this animal is doing poorly is due to fishing on spawning aggregations. This animal only reproduces a couple of days out of the year. On winter full moons, for about 5 to 6 days, Nassau Grouper will go from thousands and thousands of kilometers in square area of reef to a single location on a particular area in a reef, and they'll form this massive aggregation. Historically, those aggregations were in the tens of thousands to perhaps even as much as 100,000. These days, there are very few aggregations left that have more than 1,000 fish. There is only a few exceptions to that, and Little Cayman Island is one of those exceptions. This is a photograph from Little Cayman Island. It was taken about 2 years ago by a talented photographer by the name of Jim Hellam. That's another picture just to get you a feel for what these aggregations look like. Pictures don't really do it justice, though, even though these are amazing. So I wanted to show you a video of what it looks like. This is a video that we shot last year during our research expedition down to the Cayman Islands in February. And what you're looking at is roughly 4,000 fish all spawning right at the cusp of darkness as we move into nighttime. They spawn at the very edge of the shelf, where the shelf breaks from about 90 feet of depth and drops down vertically to about 2,000 to 3,000 feet in depth. Normally, at that site, the currents are very high, the waves are rough, but if you get underwater, the visibility can be 150 plus. Amazingly clear water. Once these fish start releasing their gametes, you can see that's me photobombing, by the way. Once they start releasing the gametes, the visibility at this site can drop to virtually zero. And as you're watching these animals spawn over the course of this evening, you can see the visibility really dropping. We have lots of research ongoing at the site. This is a hydrophone that records the sounds of spawning fishes. We also have an ADCP to record the oceanography during the spawning event. And as you're watching this video, you're seeing divers with nets swimming through the spawn. We're actually using those plankton nets to collect eggs so that we can look at genetics to try and match offspring or juveniles that show up on the home reefs with females that are spawning at the spawning site. And we're also looking at fertilization rates. But as you can see, you're really diving through a sea of eggs and sperm, basically. As the visibility drops, too, the fish really don't care that you're there. And so it can be kind of dangerous, because the fish don't see where they're going either, and they'll run into you a lot. And it's not uncommon to get spawned directly on, especially if you look like a big sea bass. Okay, and I wanted to show you one more quick video. This is kind of the National Geographic moment. It's hard to see, but there is a Caribbean reef shark right there, and he's hunting at that spawning site. And what he's trying to do is take advantage of spawning bursts. So you'll see him hit that spawning burst right there, and he comes through it. And he wasn't successful, sadly. Otherwise, I would have been a National Geographic videographer. But so there's that, the Caribbean reef shark there. So we have lots of sharks at the site as well. So it's a very wild and woolly place. Lots of amazing things going on out there. And what's important here to remember is that this is a very rare thing to see. The aggregation here on Cayman Island, on Little Cayman Island, is about fourfold larger than any other known aggregation left for the species. It's one of the last ones. This is what it looks like when you fish that aggregation. So these are pictures taken from Cayman Brac, which is the sister island to Little Cayman, back in 2001 and 2002, after that aggregation was discovered. This points out the fact that even with small boats, with just hook and line, and only a few of them, you can do a very good job of removing a huge amount of biomass off of that aggregation in short order. It is literally like fish in a barrel when you fish on these aggregation sites. Because the density of those fish is so high, and the site is so easily predictable in terms of where and when those fish spawn, it's very easy to catch these fish and remove them from the system once that aggregation has been found. So let's get our bearings geographically. All of this work is being done in the Cayman Islands. The Cayman Islands are located in the Greater Antilles, directly below Cuba. They consist of three islands, the island of Grand Cayman, and then the two sister islands of Little Cayman and Cayman Brac. Historically, there were as many as 8 different spawning sites of Nassau grouper on these islands. Every single one of those has been fished to exhaustion as of about 10 years ago, with the exception of number 6 here, that square. That's on the west end of Little Cayman. That aggregation was discovered back in 2001. Technically, it was rediscovered. If you talk to the really old fishermen, they knew that fish were once there, and at some point they'd been fished out, and it hadn't been fished for decades and decades. Fishermen revisited the site and found that there were lots of fish there. In 2001 and 2002, they fished that aggregation site hard. When it was first discovered, there was approximately 8,000 fish at the site. In 2 years, they'd removed a little more than half of that, almost 5,000 fish. So that aggregation was really hit hard for 2 years, but it was well documented, both underwater in terms of pictures and above water in terms of those that shots you saw of the fish being removed from the system. And the Cayman Islands both sensed an opportunity for conserving a valuable resource and also sensed the peril in allowing that fishing to keep taking place. And so the Marine Conservation Board in the Cayman Islands established complete no-take protections at that spawning site by 2003. And they did it not only for that spawning site, but for, in fact, every single known spawning site that was historically known in the Cayman Islands. They protected all of them. In 2 years, so that's a legislative lightning strike, right? So the way that they were able to make that happen was to establish those protections under a sunset clause. They said, look, we're gonna protect these sites for 8 years. If in 8 years the Cayman Islands Department of the Environment can't demonstrate that those protections are a good idea, we're going to allow those protections to sunset. So the Grouper Moon Project, in a nutshell, is designed to go out and collect the information necessary to evaluate whether or not those protections are a good idea. So are the spawning site reserves successful? And we do this in a couple of different ways. One, we look first at that large or healthy aggregation site. There's still about 4,000 fish there, and again, that's by far and away the largest aggregation of the species left anywhere in the world. What is the sphere of influence of that aggregation site? Basic questions at the start of this project that we didn't have answers to included simple things like, where are the fish coming from and where are they going to afterwards? So we needed to tackle those basic questions. Similarly, we needed to ask what was going on with these old, defunct aggregation sites. Are we simply protecting the ghosts of fish gone by? Or are we protecting the last of a very small population that happens to be left? So let's address each of those two things in turn. We have a series of questions for that healthy aggregation site on Little Cayman. Where are the fish coming from? If you talk to the local fishermen, they all made the case that these fish were coming from all over the Caribbean, from the Dominican Republic, from Jamaica, from Cuba. And in fact, very few of those individuals were from the Cayman Islands themselves. Politically, that's a really important point. Because if the fishermen are to be believed, and they really should be because they're the people out on the water all the time, then the Cayman Islands government has restricted access to a stock of fishes that the local fishermen otherwise would never have access to. So we need to figure out whether or not that's actually true. do all fish aggregate every year? If it's the case that only a small portion of all the fish around the Cayman Islands are going to the aggregation site, then these marine reserves may not be a silver conservation bullet. In fact, there may be alternate approaches to conservation that may be much more effective. So we need to do due diligence and figure out what proportion of all these fish around the islands are showing up to spawn each year. Do older fish aggregate more often? We know from the literature and going out and collecting fish and counting eggs that older fish produce more eggs than younger fish, and not just a little. They produce effectively exponentially more eggs than do younger fish. But what's more, there's mounting evidence to suggest that by and large, older fish don't just produce more eggs. The quality of the eggs that they produce is much better, so that the individual larvae that hatch from the eggs are better able to survive starvation, grow faster, the lipid content of those eggs is better. It's just simply a better egg. So if it's the case that the vast majority of the reproductive potential of this population is resting squarely on the shoulders of those few old fat females, then it's obviously important that we figure out whether or not those are the ones that are showing up, and if they are, making sure that they're protected while they're spawning is probably a pretty good idea. And then finally, answering the question of whether or not over that 8-year time period, whether or not the population is showing evidence of recovery. Do we see the population responding to those protections and making a recovery locally? Again, in places like Florida and in Bermuda, populations once fished hard elsewhere have not shown any signs of recovery. So it's up to us to try and figure out whether or not once we fish this aggregation very hard, we're going to be able to affect management action that's going to make it come back. Okay, so all of those questions, except for perhaps the last, is really a question about spatial ecology. How do animals use space during their reproductive system? And so we set up an experimental design where we ring the entire island of Little Cayman with hydrophones or listening stations, and then we subsequently tagged fish with little acoustic pingers that were uniquely identifiable by those hydrophones. By doing that, we could track how animals move around the island. We tagged a total of 50 fish, 30 fish from the aggregation site itself, and then 20 fish from various sites around the island. By tagging fish at the aggregation site itself, we can figure out where the fish are going home to. And by tagging various fish around the islands, we can get at that question of what proportion of the fish around the islands show up every year. We did this starting back in 2005, and we followed those tags for a period of about 2 to 3 years, maybe as much as 4. That's about the tag life of those acoustic tags we stuck in. We have all the data now, so we start to address these questions. So in short order, back to our questions from Little Cayman, where are those fish coming from? If you look at a map of Little Cayman Island, for your reference, down here is the spawning site on the west end of Little Cayman. Up here on the east end is an old, now defunct, historic aggregation site. Each of the colored squares here represents a home site for each fish that we tagged in the system. We were able to get at this both using our acoustic net that we set around the island, but also using a towed acoustic array from the back of a boat. We circled the island many, many times, and we could find individual fish over and over again and establish where their home site was. The blue squares represent fish that were tagged at the aggregation site itself, whereas the red squares represent fish that were tagged at various sites all around the island. If you counted up all those squares, you get to about 50. What that means is that every single fish in the system is from the island of Little Cayman and from nowhere else. All fish that are showing up at that west end spawning site are only from the island of Little Cayman. Do all fish aggregate every year? We can get at this question by actually animating the acoustic net data that we've collected. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you a visual of how all of our tagged fish in the system in 2006 moved around the Little Cayman Island during the spawning season. So I'm going to start this animation, and I'm going to walk you through it while it's going. Up at the top here represents the lunar phase from full moon to new moon. The red bar here represents real time of what day we're looking at. They spawn starting around the full moon to as many as 8 days after the full moon. In this year, they spawned in January. So as you're seeing real time moving up on the day of full moon, the various fish around the island are starting to move to the aggregation site. Each colored square there represents a fish. The red arrows indicate movement. By about 1 to 2 days after the full moon, there's lots and lots of movement around the island. One of the things you'll notice is that fish aren't making a beeline straight for the aggregation site. They're doing a lot of exploring. Nonetheless, by about 4 or 5 days after the full moon, every single individual in the system is at the West End site. But they're consistently going up and exploring that old historic aggregation site. Come the day of peak spawning, right around the 4 days after the full moon, the entire population of Nassau Grouper is on that West End spawning site. They're all there. So to the question of what proportion of fish show up, it's every single reproductive aged individual in the system, near as we can tell. Do older fish aggregate more often? Well, the short answer is no, they don't, and that's because every single individual goes, right? But it turns out that bigger fish showed up earlier and stayed longer at the aggregation site. And the net effect is the same. If you allow fishing at that aggregation site, the fish that are going to be most exposed to prolonged fishing pressure are going to be those individuals that are staying there longer, and those individuals that are staying there longer are the big, old, fat females with lots of eggs in their belly. They get more jeopardy when fishing takes place on those aggregation sites. And then finally, to that question of whether or not the population is responding, we're getting at that question in a series of different ways. It turns out, you might think because all of those fish are in this very dense location on a reef, they're going to be easy to count. Or maybe you don't think that, but trust me, it's not true. They're very, very challenging to count, especially when you have 4,000 large fish at roughly 100 feet of depth on a cold, dark place with giant waves knocking you about. You jump in the water, and trying to make a visual estimate of the number of fish can be quite a challenge. Nonetheless, we brave it and we do it. We go down and we send a team into the water every single day during the spawning season, and we have them do counts. But we supplement that with a couple other pieces of information. Most importantly is we do in-situ tagging. In other words, with divers in the water, we put a little small spaghetti tag on the back of fish, and we know the number of fish that we've tagged in the system. We subsequently go in and we make counts of tagged to untagged individuals. That ratio of tagged to untagged individuals allows us to make an estimate of the population size of fish moving forward. And so we have these multiple lines of evidence that allow us to make a reasonable estimate of the total number of fish that are showing up at the aggregation site through time. And this is what that data looks like, starting in 2003, moving forward. Even with the best types of data collection we've been able to come up with, there's quite a bit of variability or warble in our estimates of the number of fish showing up. Nonetheless, there's a clear and apparent increase in the number of fish moving through time, suggesting that there is, in fact, at least numerically, the number of fish. The number of fish is increasing in time. But we can look at recovery in another way as well, in terms of changes in the size distribution of those fishes that are showing up at the aggregation site. Ultimately, trying to answer this question of whether or not there are more teenagers on the spag. So if you expect that recovery is ongoing in a population, new individuals that weren't reproductively active before are going to be recruiting to the system when they become reproductively active, and they're going to be small. So you would see lots and lots of teenagers entering the system, and you might expect the skew in the population in terms of size to skew towards smaller individuals. That's a sign of recovery. How do we get at that information? We use laser video calipers. So we send divers down with video cameras, and those video cameras have lasers mounted on the side of them. So these two lasers, they're perfectly parallel. And so they're 25 centimeters apart. So it doesn't matter how far away I'm standing from an object I'm interested in measuring. The dots from those lasers are always going to be exactly 25 centimeters apart. So if we put those lasers on the side of the fish with the video rolling, because we know the length in terms of the distance between those two dots, we can use that ruler or measuring stick to get at the total size of the individual that we just measured. So we can do that. We can post-process the video. So we do that with hundreds and hundreds of individuals each year, and we get a size distribution. So this is the average or mean length of fish in terms of millimeters as a function of years, starting in 2004 right the way through 2010. And there is a consistent decrease in the size of fish showing up at the aggregation site, suggesting that recovery is ongoing or there are more teenagers moving into the system. Now, of course, it could be that fish are getting smaller because we're losing the big old females off the back end, right? But if we actually look at the range in terms of the min-max for sizes of fish showing up at the aggregation site as a function of year from 2004 right the way through 2010, if anything, that range is increasing. So we still have those big old individuals that are spawning. We're getting more and more teenagers showing up in the system, indicating demographic recovery in the population. Okay. let's jump over to Cayman Brac and ask that question of what's going on at those old defunct aggregation sites. Are we protecting the ghosts of fish gone past, or are we protecting those last few individuals in the system? There's a series of hypotheses in the literature for why it might be that Nassau grouper fail to recover once they've been fished very, very hard. Or more generally, why aggregating species in general fail to recover when fished hard. One of the hypotheses is that fish simply look around their home reefs, perceive the density of other reproductive age individuals to be so low that they forego spawning altogether, live to fight another day. So they're taking cues from their home reefs to decide whether or not to spawn, see that there are no other reproductive age individuals, and they don't put out the energetic expense to make the eggs and sperm, and they don't make the migration to the aggregation site. Or alternatively, it might be the case that fish are investing in eggs and investing in sperm, and they are picking up and leaving their home reefs and wandering around from reef promontory to reef promontory. But the ecological knowledge with regard to where the spawning site is has been lost in the system due to the removal of all the large individuals, all the old fish that know where to go. And so these individuals are wandering around from one spot to the next, never building up a critical mass needed in order to spawn. Or finally, it may be the case that they do go to spawn, they can find the old spawning site, but once they get there, the density of other individuals is so low that they ultimately make the decision to reabsorb their gametes and go home. It's like going to a dive bar, right? You go to a dive bar and there's a couple of old snaggle-toothed individuals bellied up to the bar. You're not going to be releasing gametes there. So that's their decision that they're going to go home. So these are fundamentally a spatial set of questions, and so we did the exact same experimental setup as we did on Little Cayman, but now we did it on Cayman Brac. So here's the sister island of Cayman Brac. On Cayman Brac, the historic spawning aggregation site is on the east end. In fact, there were two historic spawning aggregations, but most recently they've been up on the east end spawning site in living memory of the fishermen. I'm going to animate the data. We tagged a total of about 30 fish in the system. We didn't do as many as on Little Cayman because it was harder to catch fish. There's not a lot left there. This is data from 2007. The setup's the same, where you're looking at the lunar phase from full moon to new moon. The red bar indicates real time sped up. They spawn in February of 2007. So we're looking at fish starting to move around the island about 10 days before the full moon in February. I started the animation earlier because the fish are moving quite a bit more on this site. This purple fish that you're going to see moving around circled the island something like 9 times and covered more than about 400 kilometers in total distance, and an island that's roughly about 11 to 12 kilometers in length. So making a huge amount of investment in moving around the island searching for the right place to be. Nonetheless, about 4 or 5 days after the full moon, when peak spawning happens, every single fish in that system is at that spawning site. They're all there. So we can answer all those questions at once. It turns out that none of those hypotheses appear to be true, at least in the island of Little Cayman Brac. In fact, these fish are doing the exact same thing as the fish on Little Cayman Island. It's just there's fewer of them left. Okay, so I'm going to show you a relationship that I think gives us a hint as to what's going on with the fact that this population, this species is failing to recover once it's been fished very hard. Here is the hours spent aggregating on the y-axis, and the x-axis is fish size in centimeters. There's two different pieces of information here. The red dots with a red line through them are fish on Little Cayman, and the green line, that is fish from Cayman Brac. Two things to note. One is that we told you before that older fish spend longer at the aggregation site, and if we look at this data, that holds true, right? So bigger fish out here spend longer at the aggregation site. While that relationship in terms of the slope of those lines is the same between the two islands, it turns out that a pound for pound, fish on Cayman Brac spend a lot more time at the aggregation site than they do on Little Cayman. And we can push this a little further and gather some data over from the U.S. Virgin Islands from an aggregation that's very small, of about 500 fish, and plot the same information. And again, we see a step change where, regardless of the fish size, across all fish sizes, fish are spending a lot longer at the spawning site than even on Cayman Brac. So there appears to be this relationship where as you reduce the number of fish on the spawning site, the amount of time that the fish spend at that aggregation increases. those few individuals spend longer and longer at the aggregation site. And so maybe we were thinking about this all wrong. We were thinking that those spawning behaviors, that aggregating behavior, was breaking down, but maybe it's intensifying. And you can imagine how that would affect the population. Because even if we allow a small amount of fishing pressure on a very, very small aggregation, that fishing pressure is going to do a really good job at getting access to the last few fish that are there, because they're simply staying at that aggregation site much, much longer. And so we have this synergistic effect where knocking down the population makes those few individuals that are left more and more susceptible to any amount of fishing pressure. Okay. So that's a nice tight ball for all of the findings that we've come up with so far with Grouper Moon in terms of the spatial ecology of these fishes. The next step in all of this is to take all of that information and package it up into an outreach program to try and get the word out about the findings. To try and say, look, here are all the reasons why protecting these spawning sites is probably a very good idea in terms of fisheries management if you hope to have more fish to catch into the future. And so over the last couple of years, we've really shifted gears so that not only are we continuing to do our monitoring work, but we've made a concerted effort to do education and outreach associated with our findings. And we've done this in a series of different ways. We've worked with a couple different groups to generate documentaries associated with the research that we've been doing. We've also developed a K-12 education curricula for Caymanian schools and more recently for any school in the Caribbean. And then we've been focusing on press, getting the word out in the press in terms of newspapers and TV spots, and then communicating with government officials in terms of the Marine Conservation Board and public letters and communication with ministers within the government. As to those documentaries, we've had two developed, one by Dr. Guy Harvey, who is a really well-known marine life artist. Now, he also happens to live on Grand Cayman. And so he came out with us and developed about an hour-long documentary and then subsequently did premieres and showings inside of the schools and did a really amazing job of getting that documentary out to the people that mattered, in this case, the Caymanians. We also brought out a group called Changing Seas, which is a PBS documentary team, and they developed a science-based documentary that was about half an hour long, and that was shown nationally on TV as well as internationally. And it's available online as well. In terms of education and outreach, we got a grant from the Disney Worldwide Conservation Fund to develop an education program for K-12 schools. And using that grant, we worked with an educator who came in and actually developed a series of modules that were all based on expeditionary learning, experiential learning. And we worked with two different age groups, individuals or kids that were about 7 to 8 years of age and also seniors in high school. In terms of the younger kids, we did a series of hands-on modules to really get at the notion of why Nassau grouper are an important component of Caribbean coral reefs through things like food web exercises. We also worked with kids' book author Cynthia Shaw, who wrote the book Grouper Moon, and the younger students read that book as part of the curricula, and then Cynthia Shaw actually came down and joined us and went into the classrooms to meet with the students and have sort of a celebrity showing of her. She also worked with us with the older kids, the high schoolers. She's, in addition to being a marine life author, she's an illustrator as well. And so she came in and did a module on how to do marine life illustration with the older kids. Some of them actually were pretty good, I think, anyway. Oh, you can't really see it, but that's a Nassau grouper with exceptionally large lips. So we had some really, really nice artists' renderings of Nassau grouper. One of the highlights of this program, though, was because it is really an inquiry-based experiential learning program, it's not a lecture, right? So we're trying to get students to have an experience, both through hands-on learning curricula as well as trying to get the students out into the field with us. And so we did this by actually having live uplinks from scientists in the field, both on shore where they could ask question and answer about how the research was going, but we also had an AGA mask that had I was able to talk to the students from underwater out at the aggregation site using a live uplink over a 4G connection. Before I did that, I went into the classrooms and talked to all of the students and showed them equipment so they could see how they were going to hear from me, so sort of building the excitement of the whole project. Point here is to get the students into the field, to allow them to experience what it's like to be a marine scientist, to go through that discovery, to be able to ask questions about what they're seeing, and really experience their resource. So I want to show you a compendium of that outreach dive, just to show you an actual sort of visual feel for what it was like. Bear with me. I hope this is going to work. Thank you. Gives you a sort of a feel for the impact that that kind of an education outreach program can have with the students. And while we're doing that dive, students are, each of the classrooms that we do a dive with, they're able to field a series, I'm fielding a series of questions from those students, and they're able to ask all the questions, or most of the questions that they're really keen to find out about. Okay, so to wrap up, we did have a lot of press come out, both in dive magazines and in local newspapers. Cayman Compass is really the big newspaper in the Cayman Islands. And let me tell you, if you have high school students writing in opinion pieces, the newspaper is going to publish them. And so they actually published several of the high school students' opinion pieces talking about the importance of conserving Nassau grouper. And that had a really nice big splash in terms of the press. And they were very good, very honestly quite elegant and eloquent in laying out their reasons for why conserving Nassau grouper or continuing these protections was a really good idea. Because of all of this, in terms of education outreach and getting the press, getting the word out, talking with the government, as of the end of 2012, right before last spawning season, the Marine Conservation Board re-upped the 8-year ban on the spawning site protections. So starting this last year, we have an additional 8 years of protections for those spawning sites. That's not a perfect result, but it's a darn good one. Now we need to work towards getting permanent protections for those spawning sites, at least during the times when these animals are spawning, and ultimately try and get into place protections for those spawning protections for those that population of Nassau grouper year-round in terms of catch limits in the area. And we're working on that. The Ministry of the Environment is considering a bill right now that would do just such a thing. We're hopeful by next year, sometime in mid-next year, we'll have something passed that'll be more like a permanent protection, ongoing. Okay, all of this work would not have been possible without the generous funding of donors, both in terms of government agencies like NOAA, nonprofits like the Lenfest Ocean Foundation, private foundations like the Mahoney Foundation, and then, of course, all of the people that participated in the science and helped make it all happen. Volunteers from REEF, the Cayman Islands Department of the Environment, Oregon State University. We had private vessels being donated to the cause, Pegasus Thruster, LIME, which is a cellular provider in the Cayman Islands that allowed us to stream that video to the classroom. Of course, all of the folks here at Scripps who have helped make that happen. And a lot of this work would not have been possible without the local support on the island. The local businesses and citizens within the Cayman Islands have been very supportive of the project and have helped make that happen in any number of ways. That is all I have. Thank you very much for spending the time with me. Yeah, so the question is, how has the fishing community within the Cayman Islands responded? to the protections. As with most places, there's been a mixed bag. There are some local fishermen who feel quite strongly that it's not necessary, that they still want to be able to fish those spawning sites. There are a lot of fishermen who, quite frankly, agree with it and wish that they'd been protected long ago. That's going to be the way it is with any of these types of conservation actions. You're always going to have some folks that disagree with it and some folks that are strongly in favor of it. What we've tried to do here is, with good intention, try to collect the information necessary so anybody could make an impartial decision about whether or not those protections are a good idea. And that's what we set out to do. And I think that we've done a fairly decent job of collecting that information and then getting the word out. It's up to the Cayman Islands government now, hopefully with our help through this education outreach, to convince most of the people that it's a good idea. But I think the proof will be in the pudding. 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, the Cayman Islands is going to be one of the last places in the Caribbean that has Nassau grouper. And what I really hope happens is that they become the seed for recovery in Nassau grouper as a population throughout the Caribbean. That's really where it's at. Yeah, so the question is whether or not anybody's thought or tried to do stocking to recover the populations in places where they've been fished out or fished to exhaustion. There actually has been a little bit of research done to do hatcheries for sea basses in general, and in particular Nassau grouper. But outplanting has been miserable in terms of successes. So you grow them up to about that big, you put them out in the environment, and then there's none left in short order. Hatchery programs in general it's hard to demonstrate that they're actually effective at what they do. And unless you have a huge amount of money to put towards a hatchery program to develop it, you're not going to be very effective with a small hatchery program. And unfortunately, throughout most of the Caribbean, the governmental resources in order to establish a very large hatchery program just aren't there. Even if they were, my honest opinion is that they probably wouldn't work. I think you're much better off approaching it from a top-down perspective where you limit harvest and allow the population to recover as it tried to seed the bottom up, seed more fish into the system. That's right. So the question is whether or not, to be clear as to whether or not fish are coming from all over the Caribbean to one aggregation site or if they're really very insular. In other words, only fish from an island go to the aggregation on that island. And I apologize if I wasn't clear on that. Yes, most definitely. Fish from an island never leave their island. They do not make abyssal migrations. They don't go out into blue water. They stay on their shelf edge. And what that means is not only are the fish on Little Cayman that are showing up at that spawning site Caymanian fish, they're only from the island of Little Cayman and nowhere else. In terms of the number of fish, probably two things going on there. One is in some years, there's a big month and there's a not so big month in the winter. So most fish go at least two out of the winter months. Some go as many as four immediately after the full moons. Most fish go twice. However, there is one particular month when almost all the spawning takes place, when all the fish are there. Sometimes when the moon is split, if the full moon falls on the 15th of January and then the 15th of February, that's what we call a split moon, and we can't predict what the big month is going to be. We just don't know. We don't know whether or not the big month is January or February. Now, if the full moon falls more like the 18th or the 25th of January, then we know it's going to be on January. So those months were probably two of the years where we missed the mark. And we went down there on one of the weaker months. And so you see a dip in the population. The other thing that goes on is, quite honestly, as I said, our data, even though we do our best to collect as close to the right data as possible, there's a lot of uncertainty in it. And so you could just be seeing variability in terms of our estimates being just flat off for those 2 years a little bit. So I think it's a combination of things. It's variability in the count data that just happens because of the minutia of how the biology works and how our observation systems work. So you really need to focus on the trend and what the population is doing through time. Yes, please. Yeah, okay. So the question is whether or not the lionfish invasion that's ongoing in the Caribbean might be influencing the Nassau grouper populations. So those of you who don't know lionfish, which there's actually a tank with lionfish, or is it still there? I know it was there. There's a tank with lionfish just around the corner over there, so you can see them. They're Indo-Pacific lionfish, Pteroas volvatans. They were introduced into the Caribbean by the aquarium trade. Not specifically the aquarium tried to do it, but near as we can figure, people released them for the aquarium, and then a couple of them got together and made sweet babies, and you had lionfish everywhere all of a sudden. And so the invasion starting right around 2000 really took off, and lionfish have now spread throughout the entire Caribbean. In certain places like the Bahamas, they're very, very dense. They're much more dense than any other native predator on the system. And in part, they do well because nothing eats them in the Caribbean. There's nothing like them in the Caribbean, so nothing knows how to eat them. And also, none of the prey in the Caribbean, the small fishes, the juveniles, have seen anything like their hunting style in the Caribbean, so they're sitting ducks. So they lay waste to places where they're feeding. Invariably, lionfish are eating Nassau grouper. Nassau grouper, on the other hand, don't appear to be eating lionfish, at least in any concerted way, yet. Although perhaps they will either, evolutionarily speaking, perhaps they will in short order generate the ability to take lionfish. As it stands right now, where there are lots of lionfish, I do not doubt at all that lionfish are doing a very good job of eating lots and lots of juvenile Nassau grouper. So it's one more of those slings and arrows that impacted reefs must face in an increasingly anthropogenically mediated world, right? Whether or not those lionfish are the root cause of recovery, at this point I doubt it, but it certainly is a contributing factor. Yes, please. Yes, so the question is whether or not there are aggregations elsewhere in the Caribbean, specifically the Mesoamerican reefs, and follow on to that is whether or not you can train Nassau grouper to be lionfish hunters.
Or
anything, okay. There are Nassau grouper reasonably large aggregations in a couple other places. Belize has a few. The Mexican Caribbean has a few. The Bahamas and Turks and Caicos have some of the larger aggregations still remaining. Mexico still fishes them pretty hard, so it's not clear whether or not the last time they were monitored, there were aggregations in the thousands. Whether or not they're still there is anybody's guess. It's hard to find resources to monitor these sites, and the monitoring is, quite honestly, is a challenge. They tend to pick the spot on the map that you least want to dive on. Meshes of currents and waves and you know, nasty shelf breaks. So it's hard to go out and collect that information. Nonetheless, yes, there are some. What the status of those things are currently is not clear. Belize has a pretty nice monitoring program, though, although their populations are not doing all that well. As to the feeding lionfish to native predators, my personal opinion is that's a really bad idea. It doesn't train Nassau grouper to feed on lionfish. It trains Nassau grouper to get a handout from a diver.
Yeah.
And it also trains them to be really bold with divers and chew on fingers. And this has been a problem, especially in those places that have been feeding animals. Things like Caribbean reef sharks and morays are very aggressive, and people have been getting bit. I don't think it's going to train the animals to be lionfish hunters. It's like training a dog. You're training it to react to you, not to be a hunter. So upshot is, I don't think that's going to work, and I don't think people should be doing it because it makes the rest of us divers have to worry about sharks and morays chewing on our ankles.
Well, Bryce, thank you very much for a wonderful
presentation. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.